Want more stories in your life without adding to your TBR? That's where Audible comes in. I use it for the original novellas, the Plus catalog like Deanna Reborn's Veronica Speedwell series, and those audiobook sales that you can beat. Right now, Audible has a special offer for new and returning members. Click the link in the show notes to see what deal you'll get and start listening today. Welcome to the What to Read Next podcast. In this podcast, your host, Lori Amin, will interview published authors to chat about their work, journey to getting published, and their book recommendations. If you share a passion for books and always looking for your next read, then join us.
Hi, Allison. Welcome to What to Read Next podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
So happy to have you here. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
My name is Allison Cochran. My pronouns are she, her, and my debut novel, The Charm Offensive, comes out in just over a month from right now. So it comes out September 7th. I have been a high school English teacher for the last 11 years, just outside of Portland, Oregon. And so that has taken up a lot of my time and emotional energy. And then I write in the summers and in the evenings and on the weekends sometimes when I can.
I love this. So were you always a writer, always wanted to write, or was it something that just came later in life, you know, it's a creative process thing?
Yeah, I was always writing. I started pretty young. I think I wrote my first like quote unquote book when I was in kindergarten or first grade. I know like that it was a Barney the Purple Dinosaur fanfic. So that is what I wrote about and was very proud of it. And so I've been writing my whole life, and kind of as an adolescent, like growing up, I knew I either wanted to write or teach. And I went with teaching in terms of like professions to pursue because it was a little bit more dependable. And then sort of kept writing as a hobby that I did just for myself up until very, very recently. So
I love this. And so talk to us about the writing process of The Charm Offensive. Like, when did you start writing? Like, how long did it take you from start to finish? You know, like the whole process of like where we now see in the shelves, like when this interview airs.
Yeah. So it's the beginning is a very like unusual process. So I had the idea for The Charm Offensive as like a gay bachelor who falls in love with his producer in June of 2019. And the idea kind of came to me and I sat down to write it the next day. And then in 6 days wrote the first draft. And so, yeah, which is not normal and like not something I recommend. I don't think that was like the healthiest creative process. I did not do a lot of like sleeping or eating or showering during that time. But I just, it kind of was one of those stories that came so much from my own like personal feelings and experiences that it kind of just like poured out of me. And obviously it was a horrific first draft. And then I spent the rest of the summer revising it and then started the process of querying agents in September of 2019. And then signed with my agent in November. And we had to do some pretty intense revisions. So we did that for about 4 months and then went on submission, I think late March of 2020. So like right after pandemic shut down, started doing the submission process, trying to find a publisher. And then I ended up signing, getting the deal with my publisher at Atria in early June of 2020. Yeah. And then still lots of revising after that to get it where it is today.
Yes. And I love the final product. So
thank you.
Great job. So let's chat about The Charm Offensive. What is the elevator pitch?
So the elevator pitch is literally just gay bachelor. I think is kind of the key selling point. The slightly longer elevator pitch is that it is about sort of socially awkward and anxious tech genius who goes on a reality dating show in an attempt to kind of reboot his public image. And in the process of doing that, ends up, instead of falling in love with the 20 female contestants who've been brought on the show to date him, falls for his male producer instead.
Mm-hmm. And it's so good because it delves into anxiety, it delves into sexuality, the spectrum of sexuality, it delves into OCD, like just it goes into different heavier topics, but at the same time, it doesn't lose the story of, you know, we're in a bachelor, you know, and here's an imperfect bachelor that can make great TV, but we want to, and we have a producer who's like, I want to protect this bachelor at all costs, you know. Why pick The Bachelor, you know, in terms of, you know, like valid TV, you know, premise?
Yeah, so I watch a lot of reality dating shows.
Okay.
And so I, and like have a very complicated relationship with them, especially because they are overwhelmingly heteronormative.
Yeah.
And so, but I have been sort of, I feel like in a very complicated love-hate relationship with the Bachelor franchise for like the last decade. And so I watch, like I'm still watching, actively watching Katie's season of The Bachelorette, despite the fact that like every single season I say I'm going to walk away and that I'm done. I always end up coming back to that show. And so I think that with The Bachelor, one of the things that draws me to it is it appeals a little bit to the hopeless romantic in me. I mean, I love all reality dating shows, but a lot of them, like, no part of you believes that the people are there for love, right? Like, I'm trying to watch season two of Too Hot to Handle right now, right? And no part of me thinks that one of those people is going to walk out with their soulmate. Like, that is just not going to happen. Like, right. So you don't really buy into that sort of illusion that of that fairy tale love. And I think The Bachelor, even though, you know, the contestants are there to get Instagram followers, right, or launch their modeling career or their acting career, you know that. But the show does such a good job trying to trick you into thinking that it's like real love by the end. Mm-hmm. And I just find that there's something really appealing about that, that despite my cynicism, and like, despite my logic, I still kind of by the end get a little bit tricked into thinking like, but this could be the rare moment where the couple stays together, right? Because they do have couples who are success stories.
I watched like Tristan and Ryan, who's been together for like 20 years, you know? So
yeah.
Couple.
And it's like a very small percent, right? A very small percent of them stay together, but it's been enough that you kind of can, you can get kind of wrapped up in it, and it's like watching a real life romance. And so even though I like hate it, I also love it. And I think that was why it's more the kind of format of the fake reality dating show more mirrors the format of a show like The Bachelor, where there's a little bit of belief. Like there's a little bit of, you could be one of those people who finds love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have to say, I have a love-hate relationship with The Bachelor. I think I watched Colton seasons and probably The Bachelor afterwards, but I stopped watching it. I was like, okay, like I think for me, the fandom is so toxic. Like, it's just
yeah.
Like your space that, you know, either you love it and you're all over the place, or you hate it and you're all over the place. And so I ended up, like, I think this summer I discovered that I love the ones who are F-boys, you know, the ones who are not there for the right reasons. Too Hot to Handle is one example. Love Island, you know, like those who are like, they're just like horny and they're just like getting it on. And they're like, you know, it's not going to be end up. They're not going to get married, or there's no like expectation. And I think maybe that's like, because I'm like looking at them, like, it's just a happy for now, not a happy later after.
Yes.
The Bachelor is telling you the HEA, like it's a romance novel. It's a happily ever after, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, and the fandom is super toxic. And I think a lot of that stems from like the toxicity we see on the show itself, right? And especially around, well, obviously, you know, we saw a lot kind of in the news with Matt's season, the racism and the lack of inclusivity that the show has perpetuated for like 20 years. But I think also too, like, we see a lot of toxic masculinity that plays out, and then that's mirrored in the fandom, and a lot of, you know, internalized misogyny about how women treat each other. And so I think it also, there's that desire to like, take this thing that I love and hate and maybe make it a little bit less awful.
Yes, I think you did a good job, because it was like, it's a show that I will watch. And even that is still brought its own issues when, you know, the whole coming out process and how the producer was like, oh no, we can't, you know, controlling the narrative, and then realizing like, that's not okay. And, you know, being able to see a change, like, I think that's like a possibility of seeing a change of, you know, that it can be different, you know, but we still see the producers trying to manage, you know, the narrative. So what kind of books do you read? Do you read romance? Do you read any other genres? Like, what's your go-to?
Romance has been my go-to for the last couple of years, especially, which is part of why, like, this, I wrote a romance novel. I love the romance genre. And I especially love the, like, kind of growing number of mainstream, traditionally published queer romances that are out there. So I read a lot of queer romance. I also read a lot of queer young adult books, because young adult is a genre that has more so than romance in kind of the mainstream, really has a lot of like diverse stories within the LGBTQIA plus community. So I read a lot of those as well. And I think that, you know, a lot of times they deal with sort of finding yourself, finding your sexuality, and kind of the ways in which those two things work together. And I definitely think that influenced the way that I wrote The Charm Offensive.
Yeah, I think it just, like, it was a bit of coming of age of literal life, which I appreciate, because I'm like, I didn't come of age in my teenage years. Like, reality was, like, it was a later in life process. It was in my 20s when I realized certain things. And even in my 40s, I'm turning 40 tomorrow, I realized that I'm still coming to terms with, like, my sexuality, my, like, what I see myself in my views and all the different things. Like, you know, it doesn't get to be attached to, you just need to figure out by 18, you know, or 20, you know. And I think that I appreciate seeing, you know, queer romances coming up, you know, with older characters, you know, because we see it a lot in YA books. But I think I'm grateful that traditional published books are coming out with, you know, just adult romances that explore that.
Yeah, same. And happy birthday tomorrow. And yeah, I think there is room for so many different kinds of queer stories, but I think within romance and like having older characters who are still figuring out their sexuality, especially like kind of the complex nuances of sexuality, is important to me. I love seeing that representation as someone who came out much later in life. You know, I did not figure that out as a teenager. So I really appreciate being able to see older characters still grappling with all parts of their identity, not just their sexuality. Because of course the characters in my book also are still figuring out how to deal with their mental health and how to prioritize different aspects of their lives.
Well, what's your research like to get the mental health part right, you know?
A lot of the mental health storylines, I just was writing from my own experiences. And so as much as possible with both of the characters, I tried to focus on my own lived experiences and what I have been through. And then of course, like talk to other people as well about their experiences, and had people with different mental health diagnoses and mental illness read the book. But yeah, a lot of their experiences were just pulling from my own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really appreciate the anxiety representation and the depression, because I think sometimes we gloss it over. We're like, oh, I'm so depressed. And it's like, no, there's symptoms and there's things that happen, you know, when you're depressed that you can gloss it over, like just like, oh, I'm so depressed, like, you know. And I appreciate that, you know, we were able to see a character arc of going through it and then still and overcoming and going through recovery and trying to figure out how to manage your mental health.
Yeah, and it's hard because, you know, within romantic comedies, we expect a certain amount of resolution, right? They have to have this happy ending. And so in choosing to have the characters like struggling with their mental health, I think it was hard because I didn't want to give the image that their mental health was resolved at the end, right? That I am able to talk about my anxiety and depression a lot more, and, you know, I am in treatment for that and take medication for it, but that doesn't mean it's like resolved in my life. Mm-hmm. And so just making sure that trying to honor that for a lot of people, that's a lifelong process. And that doesn't mean it's always horrible, right? But that it isn't something that is miraculously cured after three sessions of therapy. And I think sometimes it can feel that way when we see mental health portrayed, that it can be just such a blip.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's like the identification. I feel like sometimes they assume I have struggled with mental health, I struggle with anxiety. Anxiety is like the one pervasive, you know, diagnosis. I have all the other diagnoses and I've gotten and I've dealt with recovery and I've seen the process of it. And so for me, I appreciate seeing other characters struggling with it and learning how to cope with it and learning to live with it, because it's just not going to go away. Like your thought process is, you still may have catastrophic thinking. You may have rumination. You may have a panic attack. You may feel social anxiety. And like, it's nice to know like you're not alone. I think that's like what it feels validating as someone who struggles with it. It's I'm not alone. I'm seeing somebody else struggle with it and being able to fall in love, you know, like, because I think sometimes you just think about like, you're struggling with anxiety, struggling with depression, you're not good enough, you have all this thought process, and therefore you're going to be dying alone for the rest of your life, you know? And it's nice to know like that's, you know, romance novels can teach you that there's a possibility out there and you can have a healthy relationship, you know, at some point too.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think too, you know, I like seeing mental health in my romance novels, obviously, because that's my reality. Like, mm-hmm. I live with anxiety and depression and I love romance. And so I enjoy seeing that. And I think it's hard. There's that feeling and that kind of notion that you have to be like 100% perfect in order to be like, just to be your best, all the work. I really important too, that we all deserve love.
Yes. Yeah. We all deserve love. So what have been a couple of books you have read this past year or last year that you recommend?
Oh my gosh. So many. I think maybe my favorite book so far of 2021 is The Gunkle, by Stephen Rowley. I loved that book. I loved that I was crying and laughing like at the same time in multiple scenes. And that's not a romance, but it is just a wonderful book. So that's one of my favorites. I think one of my favorite romances I've read this year isn't out yet. It's Weather Girl by Rachel Lynn Solomon. It's coming out in January. And it's another romance that also has a lot of mental health representation. And I think just like talks about depression in really authentic and genuine ways. And so that is one, if you like mental health rep in your romance, I highly, highly recommend it.
Adding that book to my TBR. I know I'm like a huge fan of Rachel Lynn Solomon's book. So I'm like, this is just like an added bonus, you know? Your mental health rep, you know. So tell us where you can find you online.
You can find me at my author website, alisoncochran.com. You can find me on Instagram in terms of social media that I know how to use. Instagram is the number one. So, and it's, my handle is just Alison Cochran. I'm also on Twitter, sort of. I don't really know how to use Twitter. It scares me. But you can find me there as well.
Awesome. Thank you, Alison, for being on the show.
Yeah, of course.
If you enjoyed this podcast, feel free to share it with friends, subscribe, rate, and review the show. This is the easiest way to support the podcast. For book recommendations, author interview archives, and other fun book resources and tips, please visit whatyoureadnextblog.com. The What You Read Next podcast is part of the Frolic Network. To discover new shows to listen and love, please visit frolic.media/podcast. Thank you so much for listening and have a great day.
Are you an author, publisher, or book-related business looking to reach passionate readers? What to Read Next podcast is a perfect place to connect with an engaged audience of romance and mystery lovers who are always on the hunt for their next great read. Now, we're offering sponsorship opportunities. Whether you're launching a new book, promoting an upcoming release, showcasing a bookish product or services, we can help you get the word out. Let's work together to bring your books or businesses to readers who are ready to discover something new. Please visit whatyourreadnextblog.com/sponsorships to learn more or reach out to chat about the perfect sponsorship or package for you. Thank you much for listening. Your next great reader is waiting for you.